Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio, 103.1 FM, 910, 980 AM, or anywhere on that free Odyssey app. It is 409, 90 degrees on the board here in Pittston on this Wednesday, June 4th, 2025. I don't want to hear a single one of you say it's too hot outside. It was great outside. Beautiful, get some things done. Some weather's moving in, but we'll deal with it. You know, that's what the early summer, late spring is supposed to be about. So Zelensky bombed Russian airfields. Putin told Trump during a telephone conversation today that he will respond. And Zelensky is now proposing a ceasefire. It's going to be interesting times out there. And listen, to hear about what took place with the Russian strategic bombers is just incredible. But what's being left out of the whole, you know, how good this attack was and how devastating it was to Russia was at the very same time, Russia was really pounding Ukraine as well and gaining hundreds of miles of ground. So in the big picture of things, as for, you know, a daily who won, who lost, it's very close to a draw. But the strategic bombers are a hit for Russia because it's not something they can replace anytime soon, if at all. Now, here's some problems that need to be discussed with this. The reason why those bombers were out in the open is because of a nuclear agreement with the U.S., where Russian bombers need to be out in the open so our satellites can see them, just like our bombers need to be out in the open so Russian satellites can see them. It's to prove that, you know, we're not arming everything up. We're not preparing for anything. They're not missing in somewhere in flight somewhere. So will this be used by the Russians, President Putin, to turn around and say, we're no longer going to abide by this treaty because it's leaving our infrastructure vulnerable? It very well could. And you also have a phone call that lasted an hour and 15 minutes per reports from the White House, where President Trump spoke to Vladimir Putin. And Putin did, in fact, say that he would respond to these attacks on the Russian bomber infrastructure and what that means, what it entails. I know there's been a lot of fear as far as stepping this up to a nuclear response. Does Russia respond with a tactical nuke somewhere in Ukraine to let them know that there's a red line that they will not pass? They're getting desperate. So I know military analysts in the U.S. are concerned that could be an option. Hopefully that option was discussed and taken off the table during the conversation today between the two presidents, but we will see. It's interesting because they were also meeting that day for peace talks, Ukraine and Russia. And those peace talks fell apart and lasted less than an hour because of the ongoing back and forth and the striking of these bombers. But the mission itself is something out of James Bond, you know, akin to the beeper and cell phone and radios that Israel did with Hezbollah, where they smuggled in these fabricated houses with remote-controlled roofs and these drones, and they placed them strategically around the area of these airfields. And by remote control, they were able to remotely open the roofs of these structures, and the drones took off closer to the target and were able to strike their target. So this is something that they say was planned for over a year and just came to fruition. But it's interesting that it was on the same day that peace talks were taking place. So do either side truly want peace? At this point, it doesn't appear so. But we'll see where it moves from here. So that's a little update on what's going on there, because it was quite the operation. But literally, our media is really only talking about one side of it, because there were massive strikes from Russia in Ukraine and a lot of ground gained by Russia that was previously lost. The other thing that we touched on yesterday as it was breaking were these Chinese national couple charged with smuggling crop-killing funguses into the U.S., potential agroterrorism weapon. Now, you know, yesterday I kind of started rambling off the economic impact that this would have. And basically, it affects our cereal crops, our wheat, our barley, our corn. This would be devastating. If there was a widespread blight of our cereal crops, we would no doubt be thrust into a depression. You're talking hundreds of billions of dollars. You're talking increased costs, inflation, our food chain, the poisoning of both us and livestock. The mere fact that these two individuals were caught by U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers attempting to smuggle in this fungus, a biological pathogen considered a potential agroterrorism weapon, into the U.S. via the Detroit Metropolitan Airport, according to a criminal complaint. At this point in time, I don't see why there hasn't been already, and there may be, and we just don't know about it. There needs to be extreme vetting of anyone coming from China or any Chinese national. And that's through intermediary countries as well. So if you travel from China to Europe to America, this extra vetting needs to be done. And by extra vetting, I just don't mean who you are and why you're here and is all your paperwork in line. I mean physical searches. I mean scans. I mean anything. I mean this agroterrorism. This is a biological weapon. This is a biological pathogen that is considered an agroterrorism weapon. This is not to be taken lightly. And I understand it seems to be being downplayed as far as what actually happened, but there were people on being interviewed today saying, you know, at any other given time, this would be an act of war. If you are trying to sabotage our agricultural infrastructure, that is an act of war. If you are trying to sabotage our industrial infrastructure, it's an act of war. Our financial infrastructure, it's an act of war. There is no hiding that China has been preparing for well over a decade for a conflict with the U.S. It's open. Our military on a daily basis trains for a potential conflict with China. We are flooding assets to the South China Sea and the Pacific for a conflict with China. Now, it may not be a direct conflict between us and China. It could be Taiwan. It could be Japan. It could be the Philippines. Just like there was daily combat in the Red Sea, in the Middle East, that we didn't see day in and day out. Missiles were targeting thousands of Americans to kill them multiple times a day on a daily basis. American servicemen really didn't hear much. Matter of fact, the last administration weren't even responding to it. Well, they didn't hit anything, so, you know, there's no sense in trying to escalate. Listen, there is no, you know, we're not going to escalate the situation. Until they're all dead, it will continue. I think we've learned that in a couple places. You finally start having the ruling families in Palestine writing letters now saying that they will no longer recognize Hamas because they've brought nothing but pain to our area and us and our people. So you're starting to see a change there. China's no different. China is literally crashing ships into, and they're not using Chinese military ships. They're using their maritime ships, their fishing, so-called fishing vessels, and I use that with air quotes, that are militarized fishing vessels. They're their commercial fleets that are part of the government. They listen, there is no private companies in China. Everything is owned by the Chinese government. Everything is overseen by the Chinese government. So if you have a fleet of fishing vessels, they are government military vessels. But they can say, well, you know, it's fishing vessels, and they're just challenging the fishing territories. But they're crashing their ships into Taiwanese ships, Japan ships, Philippine ships, the coast guards of those countries. The Chinese coast guards are shooting water cannons on a daily basis and crashing into and pushing around those countries' actual commercial ships, bullying them, saying you're in Chinese territorial waters when they're obviously in international waters or their own waters. So the mere fact that these people tried to get in and they have an educational background in being able to sustain and spread this, They also lied about it. They made false statements about the visit to the U.S. and his knowledge of the pathogen before admitting to law enforcement that he was bringing the noxious fungus to his girlfriend, 33-year-old University of Michigan lab researcher, according to authorities. Why is a Chinese national with connections to the Chinese Communist Party a researcher in the University of Michigan? Again, things that need to change, things that need to stop. And then you add in the tens of thousands of Chinese nationals who made it into this country after the last administration. Now, we have no idea where or who they are. They're gotaways. Some of them were stopped, and we have an idea who they are, but we don't know where they are. What are they here for? What did they bring in? What are we seeing now that's just starting and kind of under the radar as far as a pathogen, as far as a disease, as far as anything else? The downplaying of what this could have potentially done. Listen, this fungus and a blight of our cereal crops would have sent this nation into a depression. I saw two economists and one agricultural specialist that said it would have made COVID look like a birthday party as far as shutting down everything. Supply chains, governments, everything. It is our number one agricultural crop, our cereal crops. It affects our ethanol, 40% of our ethanol production. This would have hit us, you and I, on every spectrum. But yet, they just caught the two Chinese nationals coming in. No big deal. Every red flag there possibly is should be waving right now when it comes to Chinese nationals, when it comes to anyone who has anything to do or even originating in China. They need to go through extreme vetting. They need to have extreme searches, scans. Whatever we need to do needs to start happening because it's a free-for-all. The mere fact the first time these two were stopped was at Detroit airport should scare the hell out of all of us, because it no doubt scares the hell out of me. And I used to do this for a living. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. It's 426, 90 degrees outside. One of the things I didn't even think of, and it should have been the first thing on my mind, I was thinking more of the agroterrorism part of it, is this fungus that would affect our cereal crops, wheat, barley, corn. It would have affected our beer industry and our whiskey industry, our spirits industry. Yeah, you got it. Our vodka is made from corn. Our mash for our bourbon and whiskey is made from barley, rye, and corn. You know, beer. Our oats, barley, and all these things are shipped all across the world to help other nations make beer. So it would have been devastating to our spirits industry, our beer and the rest of it. And it also, I would assume, affected our fruit crops as well, from what I'm reading into it, which now you're hitting our wine industry and our fruit industry. It was truly a terrorist act that we need to get in. Somebody says, do you really think the CCP will be held accountable over this? Unfortunately not, because we're not making the big deal that it should be over this. You know, I haven't seen an immediate announcement from the White House saying that any person originating from China will be subject to enhanced screening when they come in to our nation, sending the shot across the bow, the warning right off the bat. And while this is going on, the Democrat governor of Arizona, Governor Katie Hobbs, vetoed a law that would have stopped Chinese from buying farmland near military bases. It passed both houses in Arizona, bipartisan support. The Democratic governor, Katie Hobbs of Arizona, vetoed the law that would stop Chinese nationals from buying land near military bases, farmland near military bases, which they are doing. And here's another interesting correction from the Washington Post. You know, the mainstream media, the one of the papers of record you Democrats say we should listen to. They admit to faulty reporting. Here, Washington Post admits to faulty reporting on claim that Israel killed dozens of Gazan civilians at an aid site. The Washington Post issued a correction on a story it published claiming Israeli soldiers shot and killed 31 civilians in Gaza who were attempting to collect aid at a U.S.-run site. The Washington Post admitted Tuesday on a post on X that it could not verify the incendiary report published on Sunday, bearing the headline, at least 31 people were killed Sunday morning in southern Gaza, according to the Strip's health ministry, when Israel troops opened fire on the crowds making their way to collect aid. This wasn't a not could verify it. It was utterly wrong. It was false. It was not true. They believed the Gazan health ministry, which is Hamas, instead of vetting their own story, instead of looking at the video that was provided by the Israeli government, actually showing that it was Hamas themselves shooting people. Because they don't want the populace to get aid. They don't want help from Western civilization. So the Washington Post saying, well, they couldn't verify the story. No, it was utterly false, the story. And they ran with it anyway. And then they come out and say, well, you know, we can't verify it now. The article failed to make it clear if attribution to the deaths of Israel was the position of the Gaza Health Ministry or fact verified by the Washington Post. No, it was utterly untrue. Say, hey, we got it wrong and we posted false information. But they don't do that. No, we can't we posted false information, but now we can't verify it, so we're retracting it. After it was already published, after it's already out there, after the inflammatory rhetoric was there. Could that have maybe been complicit in antagonizing an Egyptian national for using a flamethrower on Jewish Americans in Boulder, Colorado? I'm sure it didn't help. I'm sure it didn't help. You know what also I found out that was unbelievable? While the victims of that Boulder, Colorado, those Jewish Americans that were set on fire, including two Holocaust survivors, while they were on their way to the hospital, Boulder, Colorado elected Democrats were holding a fundraiser for Ilhan Omar. Now, obviously, the fundraiser was pre-planned and had nothing to do with what was going on. But just the mere fact in hindsight, the Boulder, Colorado Democrat machine was having a fundraiser for Ilhan Omar while their Jewish constituents, Jewish American citizens of their city were being set on fire by a pro-Palestinian illegal immigrant from Egypt. You can't make this stuff up. Zero tolerance. It needs to stop. We need to stop coddling these pro-terrorist activists who are running around our nation, taking over buildings, taking over campuses, assaulting Jewish Americans, and outright committing anti-Semitism. It needs to stop. Zero tolerance. And any organization that allows it is complicit, needs to be bankrupted by a team of lawyers. It's the only way it's going to stop. It's 4:32 here at WILK. It's time for the news with Paul Michaels. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. It's the point of the show where we honor our heroes here at home who made the ultimate sacrifice in law enforcement. On this day, we have two from here in Pennsylvania. We're going to start off with Police Officer Winfred Sylvester Hunter, Philadelphia Police Department, June 4th of 1990. Police Officer Winfred Hunter was shot and killed after he and another officer tried to intervene in a fight. Both officers entered a club when they tried to break up an altercation between two men who had caused trouble in the club earlier. His assailant was convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison. Officer Hunter had served with the Philadelphia Police Department for 19 years, was survived by his son and daughter. Next, we have Corporal Joseph L. Fulton, Pennsylvania State Highway Patrol, 1936. Corporal Joseph Fulton was killed in a motorcycle accident while patrolling U.S. Route 19 in Summit Township. He had served with the Pennsylvania State Highway Patrol for less than 8 years, was survived by his mother. And those are our two from here in Pennsylvania. Jake, you got your ears on? Because I got some news that you're not going to believe. I just came across my wires here. Do you know who Navy football will be opening up the 2029 season against?
2029?
Yep.
And it's not Notre Dame, huh?
Nope.
That's a good question.
It's not a team they're known for playing.
Not a team known for playing. All right, so then that rules out Notre Dame. That rules out the
There's a lot of teams out there, so I'm not going to leave you on the hook here. September 1st of 2029, they will be playing Ohio State in Ohio.
Oh, that's awesome.
The Navy midshipmen, schedule announcement, Navy to open the 2029 football season at Ohio State. Columbus, Ohio, September 1st.
Doesn't get any better than that.
No, it's going to be a tough one. But you know what? It's same thing with Notre Dame. Navy plays a different style of offense that any team has to switch its total dynamic to play. Now, when you're in Navy's conference, you know, a lot of them play, you know, that wing T, that option type football. But even Notre Dame has to change their entire practice. And they play them once a year, every year. But they have to change their entire practice to where, you know, it's hard to keep up sometimes. Now, Ohio State will obviously be bigger. A lot of them will be faster. You know, their defensive backs and their wide receivers and such.
Right.
But, you know, playing something they're not used to, because I don't think they play another team who runs an option offense.
Not that I could think of, no.
So it's going to be interesting, and never count Navy out. But, yeah, September 1st of 2029, the Navy midshipmen will open up their football season against Ohio State. Interesting. That was just posted today from Navy Athletics.
That's great.
All right. It's 4:40 here at WILK. Time for 2020 traffic and weather together. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show. It's time for Today in History, because how do we know where we're going unless we remember where we've been? We're going to see what's happening on this day in June 4th in a minute. Jake, I did do a little research there. Yes, Navy has played Ohio State several times, with the most recent game being September 5th of 2009, where Ohio State defeated Navy 31-27.
Wow.
Sounded like a good game.
Great game.
31-27 on September 5th of 2009. Now, Ohio State has won every game they've played. They played in 1930. They played in 1931. They played in 1980 and 2005. And again, their most recent game, 2009, where Navy midshipmen almost had them. 31-27.
That's awesome. That's a hell of a shootout right there.
I'm already looking forward to 2029 now. Come on. So today in history, what else do we have today? 1919, Congress approves the 19th Amendment. On June 4th, 1919, the U.S. Congress passed the 19th Amendment, granting women the right to vote. This pivotal moment in the women's suffrage movement was a major step towards gender equality in the United States. 1942, the Battle of Midway begins. The Battle of Midway commenced on this day in 1942 during World War II. This decisive naval battle resulted in a significant victory for the United States against Japan, marking the turning point in the Pacific theater. Now, the Battle of Midway started on June 4th, but ended on June 7th. Tomorrow, I will have U.S. Navy Captain retired Kevin Miller, former skipper of the Gunslingers attack squadron. He'll be in to talk with about his book, Silver Waterfall, which is a book about the Battle of Midway and the air tactics that won that battle during that day. So that's tomorrow. We'll have him on at 4 o'clock. And then at 4 o'clock on Friday, we'll have Rear Admiral Paul Becker retired to talk about the intelligence and the battle itself, on how the planning and the chain of events that happened during that day that made that over the course of those days that made that so successful. So tomorrow we'll have Navy retired Captain Kevin Miller to talk about the air battle at the Battle of Midway. And Friday we'll have Rear Admiral Paul Becker retired to talk about the strategic intelligence and daily changes that were made to win that battle. 1944, U.S. forces captured German submarine U-505. On June 4th, 1944, U.S. naval forces seized the German submarine U-505 off the coast of Africa. It was the first time since the War of 1812 that the U.S. Navy captured an enemy vessel on the high sea. In 1944, Allied troops liberate Rome. On this day, Allied forces entered Rome, liberating the city from the Axis control. The liberation of Rome was a significant milestone in the Italian campaign during World War II. 1917, the first Pulitzer Prize was awarded. The inaugural Pulitzer Prize was awarded in 1917. These awards recognize excellence in journalism, literature, music, and setting the standard for American cultural achievements. 1939, the MS St. Louis denied entry into the U.S. The MS St. Louis, carrying over 900 Jewish refugees fleeing Nazi Germany, was denied entry to the United States on June 4, 1939. The ship was forced to return to Europe, where many passengers later perished in the Holocaust. 1989, the Tiananmen Square Massacre. While not a U.S. event, the Tiananmen Square Massacre on June 4, 1989 had global repercussions, including strong reactions from the United States. The U.S. government condemned the Chinese government's actions, leading to sanctions and reevaluation of U.S.-China relations. In 1984, Bruce Springsteen releases Born in the USA. Released the iconic album Born in the USA, the album became one of the most successful works reflecting on American life and contributing to the nation's cultural landscape. So, lots happening, especially, you know, when you get into the 1940s with everything that was happening with World War II. It's interesting where we are today. Have we learned from what took place then? Obviously not. Are we prepared? Now, we've talked about this here extensively, and I'm sure we'll touch on it when I have Admiral Paul Becker or Captain Kevin Miller on later this week, when we discuss the issues here, like we discussed during our award-winning, Jake and I, Navy Special, the world's greatest Navy, to where we did get into our infrastructure capabilities today, where we stand if something does break out with China. Because, listen, they are poking the bear. They do have saboteurs here in our country. I've had Gordon Chang, a Chinese expert, on this show many times, who said they are here and they are ready to act. It's interesting because in my previous life, when I worked as a director of public safety in Northeast Pennsylvania, I dealt a lot with the FBI counterintelligence units that were in this area who were monitoring Russian assets. And they knew Russian spies were here in our area, in our very area. They knew the Russian spies were here. They monitored what was going on. They monitored their electric use because some homes were using unusually high amounts of electricity. And you have to think why, what kind of communication devices, what kind of tools, what kind of computer infrastructure was there to use such power. Well, that interested them too. And the fact that it's not that far from Toby Hanna, which is a nationwide hub for military electronics infrastructure. And I asked him once, I was like, well, if you know they're here and they're not supposed to be here, why aren't we doing anything about it? And I was told, and again, this is over a decade ago, well, we monitor their guys, they monitor our guys, and when they snatch up our guys because they caught them, we snatch up their guys and we trade. And, no harm, no foul, we start from scratch again. Do not collect $200, do not pass go. So this is nothing new. You know, up in way in the past during the Cold War, it was always a fear. They're here now, it was a fear. And now with the... You know, that's why when we talk about porous borders, when we talk about what happened under the last administration with a lack of security and who was coming in and what little we actually stopped catching coming in, those fears are real. You know, that waving the caution flag is very real. It's not a made-up scare. It's not something, hey, we just want to say that these people coming in are a danger. They truly are a danger. And I think we're seeing it. We should have seen it all along. For some reason, it was accepted, and it's still accepted in some municipalities, to the point where you have American citizens physically impeding federal agents to remove violent felons who are here illegally. something else that's got to stop, because you're not going to win that battle, not in this day and age. It's 4:53 here at WILK. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. I'm just seeing some breaking news crossing the wires now. A Biden-appointed judge has blocked the Trump administration from deporting the family of the accused Boulder, Colorado terrorist Mohamed Soleiman. So let me get this straight. They're here illegally. Their visas are expired. The person who lives in their house committed a terrorist attack with a weapon of mass destruction, makeshift flamethrowers and Molotov cocktails. And again, they're here illegally with expired visas. They weren't arresting them. They weren't incarcerating them. They were taking them and removing them from the country because they had no right or authority to be here. And a Biden-appointed judge blocks the Trump administration from deporting them. You just can't make what's happening up. This is unprecedented with our judiciary intervening. It's just dumbfounding. Dumbfounding. And until it's almost like, hey, you get what you deserve, these cities that tolerate this. Because that's where these things are going to happen. These very Democrat-run cities that have tolerated this. The Boulder, Colorado City Council, just 3 days before this incident took place, scolded the Trump administration for deporting illegal immigrants. And then this happens. Didn't age well for them, now did it. And here, closer to home, Columbia University. One of the protesters and self-proclaimed Jew hater, that's what he calls himself, had direct links to Hamas terror cell, as per his own phone records revealed by the Department of Justice. Now, this individual is not a student at Columbia University. He is not affiliated with Columbia University, but he was one of the mainstays of the university movement, pro-Hamas movement. Now, he's awaiting trial after being indicted on 3 federal hate crimes against Jewish people. And he was a member of a chat group that received regular updates from Abu Obeida, the official spokesperson for the Brigades the deadly Al-Qassam Brigades militant group, according to allegations in the federal document. He frequently wore one of the green Hamas headbands, boasted to friends about having relatives overseas who were part of the terror group, prosecutors claim in a letter filed with the court. While on Columbia's campus during protests in April of 2024, he allegedly texted a pal saying he lit a flare and considered lighting someone on fire, but that there were too many people around for him to take on, otherwise he would have hurt them. Columbia University said it has no record of the individual being a member of campus. But yet, until he was arrested, he was allowed. Incredible. It's 5 o'clock here at WILK.